From Illinois Seoul, this is Dialogue. I'm Reginald Hardwick, News and Public Affairs Director at Illinois Public Media. Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m., we're bringing you interviews, in-depth stories, and entertainment events connected to Black communities in Central Illinois. We start with a dialogue with Urbana Police Chief Larry D. Boone, who is more than 6 months into his new role. Boone rose from an officer to chief of police during his 33-year career in Norfolk, Virginia, a city nearly six times the size of Urbana.
That I will faithfully discharge the duties in the office of police chief in the state of Illinois.
To the best of my ability.
To the best of my ability.
Thank you. Congratulations.
All right.
Welcome.
All right.
We talked about everything from an early negative experience with police to his reaction to the murder of George Floyd, and how being pictured in a Black Lives Matter march changed the trajectory of his career. And we talked about crime in Urbana and what he hopes to do about it. We taped this interview in January. Chief Boone, thank you for taking time to join us here at Illinois Seoul.
Thank you for having me.
6 months in, what do you think of Central Illinois so far?
Different. Different in a good way on multiple levels. From a professional level, you know, I'm coming from a police department with about 1,000 employees to a police department with about 100, maybe a little less than that. And when I say employees, I'm talking about not only sworn, but professional staff members as well. You know, we're talking about a city roughly about 250,000 to a city about 40,000, give or take. And certainly the politics are different. The police philosophies are different.
Boone is a native of New Jersey. He grew up with aspirations to be a pro football player. In the eighth grade, he was 6 feet tall. He stood out among his peers, but also with law enforcement. He remembers being profiled for an assault on a white man.
I remember that incident like it was yesterday. It was a snowy morning, walking to school. Two police stopped me. There was a young man in the back seat of the police car. And they positioned me in such a fashion that I was facing the young man, and he did the international shaking of his head, no. And then they turned me so that my profile was exposed to the young man. And again, he said no. And I could see upon his face that he had been assaulted because he was a white kid and his face was red and bloody. And so the police let me go, but one of them kicked me in my butt as I was walking away. And he made the comment, if it wasn't you this time, N-word, it'd be you the next time. And I was so scared, I urinated on myself. You know, that was my first direct connection with law enforcement.
Here come the blitz, and here goes Brown, and Brown goes down, and Larry Boone is the guy.
Got him, Larry Boone.
Holding down, 11:41 to go, and it's Georgia.
Chief Boone won two football national titles at Georgia Southern, but injuries sidelined a career in the NFL. Seeing a Black police officer during a football game inspired him to switch to law enforcement. He joined the Norfolk Police Department during his senior year in college, and after seven promotions became the police chief. While there, he added African Americans, Latinos, and LGBTQ officers to leadership.
A crowd grew in front of the Norfolk Police Operations Center. Posters and chants called for justice for George Floyd.
This is what it's about right here. It's about justice. It's about hate to end. It's about racism to end. We're not against whites. We're against racism.
Marchers blocked Virginia Beach Boulevard for hours.
In 2020, like many cities, massive protests broke out in Norfolk after the murder of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer. Boone recalls his response.
So I was in Norfolk, police chief, obviously, and when I saw it, my reaction was that was a slow, casual murder. I remember a local reporter reaching out to all the police chiefs in Hampton Roads. There's seven of us. And, you know, I'm not, you know, minimizing their response, but their response were so mechanical. They all said the same things. You know, it was awful. We have to wait for the investigation. You know, we don't know what happened before it was shown on TV. Well, you know, sometimes you just got to call it like it is, okay? If I'm watching the same video and I see someone suppressed under said knee for 9 minutes, I don't need an investigation. My experience of 30-plus years tells me exactly what that was and what the outcome would be. And I kind of anticipated, you know, there would be a protest of some sort, but never did I anticipate it would be of that magnitude.
Back at the operations center, Norfolk Police Chief Larry Boone stood with the crowd and walked with them for a few minutes, holding a Black Lives Matter sign.
While trying to de-escalate tensions at one protest, Chief Boone did something that immediately caught the ire of politically conservative critics.
And my defining moment as the police chief in Norfolk was participating in the march with Black Lives Matter after several threats of burning down one of my precincts. I was able to quell a group of 500 folks. One of the things I did, I didn't know this at the time, but I am the, I didn't do it for publicity. I didn't do it for anything other than to calm folks down. I am the only African-American police chief in the world to ever be photographed holding a Black Lives Matter sign. Now, some folks would, you know, say that's pretty good. And some folks would say, you're a fool. Okay. And I say that because I knew in the moment when I was kind of positioned to take that photograph, I knew it would hurt me professionally. You know, when folks are looking for a police chief, they're looking for someone that the rank and file can accept entirely. And there are some agencies that I applied to shortly after leaving Norfolk that did not think the rank and file would accept me because of that photograph. Regardless of all my achievements, and there's a lot of them out there that I embrace, I am a change agent. As I told the city of Urbana, I did not come here for you to remain the same. We're going to be different.
Do solemnly swear or affirm.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
And the Constitution of the State of Illinois.
And the Constitution of the State of Illinois.
And that I will faithfully.
As the new chief in Urbana, Boone plans to increase technology use, manpower, and engagement in the community. He recognized blind spots in the city during his visits here.
I was flown out here maybe 3-4 times. My very first visit, I recognized those things, and each subsequent visit, my belief was more intense that those were the blind spots that this department needs. I can tell you this, the spirit of the women and men of the Urbana Police Department, it's where it needs to be to make those things happen. They are compassionate. They go out of their way a lot of times to do what's right. And I say that based on observation and based on the communication I get from community. Now, let me say this. There are some communities that don't feel that way. And the reason they don't feel that way, because I will say the Urbana Police Department, we got to do better in leaning into those communities that don't necessarily trust us. And those are the things we're starting to do now by bringing folks into our department that can help foster some of those relationships.
Yeah. This spring, Chief Boone plans to have local pastors do ride-alongs with officers. It's a program he started in his last department.
Program I started in Norfolk where one of my most violent sectors had 64 churches, and I thought the church could do a little more. And one of the things I challenged them in doing it was riding with my officers in those areas just outside some of your church doors so you can see what's going on. And it provided them an opportunity, number one, to see the challenges of law enforcement. Number two, it afforded them an opportunity to provide counsel or prayer or whatever the case may be during a horrific event, particularly to a victim or the victim family. 9 times out of 10, either you're going to know the victim or the victim's going to be a member of your church, something of that sort. And, you know, crime went down drastically after that, because what I know is this. Those pastors, you know, when they ride with our officers Friday and Saturday nights, they're going to go into the church and talk about what they observe. And they're going to point to certain members that may be related to certain characters that are creating havoc and calibrate their thinking, so to speak, so they can modify their behavior. It's not always about locking folks up. If any police chief think you're going to lock your folks up to get out of this, you're sadly mistaken. It's about building authentic relationships. It's about building partnerships so folks can help you. That's where I start.
Chief Boone is aware of mistrust between police and communities of color in Urbana, and he says he's not afraid to have difficult conversations.
That authentic relationship between the African-American community as well as the Hispanic community as it relates to law enforcement. Now nothing's, you know, 100%, but I met with about 100 folks my first 3 months here. Authentic communication, they came into my office, one-on-one conversations, and we had tough conversations, and that's one of the things they highlighted. But I just think it's from that lack of bridge building. I think it's from a lack of having those hard conversations, developing those programs in which those folks that don't necessarily trust police can work with police. Some of the programs that I mentioned earlier that kind of force you to work on problem solving together. And through that, you start to learn, you know, we're no different, okay? You're just like me. We have the same concerns in mind. Why not work on it together? But because of historical positions, no one wants to, you know, reach over the aisle. Well, that's not how I work, okay? I'm going to work with all. As I said previously, I am comfortable with anybody. As long as they're willing to do the work for the greater good, I'm comfortable with you.
While violent incidents overall are down, it struck me in 2023 that there were a lot of shootings involving juveniles. What would you tell a parent or grandparent who say they can't reach a young person?
Yeah, that's not unique to Urbana, as you know. I think parents got to be parents. Unfortunately, there are a lot of folks that have kind of, you know, parented from a perspective of being a friend. You know, there is opportunities of mischief so great nowadays that if you aren't acutely aware what's going on with your child, they are going to become a statistic. You need to know where your child is at all times. If your child is particularly interested in symbolism that you don't quite understand, is probably gang-related. If they are quite fancy of a particular color, it's probably gang-related. But from a law enforcement perspective, we have to do a better job of impacting the flow of guns.
Coming up on Dialogue, Urbana Police Chief Larry D. Boone explains why gun tracking is a key to solving youth violence.
each gun, almost 100% of them were purchased legally. Very shortly, every one of those guns ended up in our black and brown communities.
He addresses pushback on his plan to hire more officers. And I ask him if being a black police chief is a thankless job because he's caught in the middle of so many agendas. Later, we'll tell you about arts and entertainment coming to Central Illinois. Plus music and memories from Branford Marsalis.
We just like playing. We're players. And we play fast songs and slow songs and pretty songs and ugly songs and hard tunes and easy tunes.
Stay tuned. You're listening to Dialogue from Illinois Soul. You're listening to Dialogue, a new weekly news magazine focused on the black communities of Central Illinois. I'm Reginald Hartwick, News and Public Affairs Director at Illinois Public Media. We're continuing our conversation with Urbana Police Chief Larry D. Boone, who is more than 6 months into his new role. Boone rose from an officer to chief of police during his 33-year career in Norfolk, Virginia. In 2023, violence involving young men made headlines in Urbana. A 14-year-old was shot and killed at an apartment in March. One man was shot near a high school in November. And a shootout near Booker T. Washington STEM Academy landed four teenagers in jail. Later, an 11-year-old was found with a backpack holding two fully loaded handguns and nearly 400 rounds of ammunition. Chief Boone says one key to solving the violence is tracking the flow of guns into the black and brown communities.
So when I became chief in Norfolk, one of the things that concerned me was just that, youth violence. There was an article one day on the front page, and it had three young black men holding a gun. Each of them was holding a gun, smiling. Obviously, the question is, how do they get these guns? So historically in my department, if we solved a crime and it involved a gun, we would voucher the gun, just put it away, nothing more. Didn't make sense to me. So what I started to mandate was every gun used in a crime, we're going to track the gun. We're going to build a database so that we know, one, who purchased the gun and where. So over the course of 5 years, hear me out, we recovered maybe 5,500 guns. Each gun, almost 100% of them were purchased legally from one particular location in the city, legally. Very shortly, every one of those guns ended up in our black and brown communities. Out of 5,500 guns, how many do you think were reported lost or stolen? 200. So what that says, if these guns are purchased legally, in short order, they're in our most challenging communities that happen to be our black and brown communities, in the hands of our youth and convicted felons. That's a machinery process that we need to look at as law enforcement. But here's the hiccup. I'm a big advocate of the Second Amendment. I own multiple guns. And a lot of police chiefs around the country, they see that as an infringement of embarking on folks' Second Amendment privilege. When I see crime, and it's an epidemic, I have to put politics aside.
In December, you faced a lot of pushbacks at a city council meeting when you asked for more than $500,000 to hire a deputy police chief and three officers. What was your reaction to that, and where are you going from here?
Well, number one, shock, because they promised me that they would give me what I wanted in order to come here. Let me just say that out loud, okay? But I understand the politics that they have to adhere to. I know I'm going back to them in the near future and I'm going to request that same. And they have a decision to make, and then I'll have a decision to make.
In 2020, black drivers were nearly half of the people stopped by Urbana police officers, although the black population is only 18%. What do you say to the community that says there's over-policing, and what can be done about that?
You know, I like to see the data on that. I can tell you what I've done in the past. We had the same problem in Norfolk, and it concerned me. But as a police chief, trying to explain data to citizens that have a concern about the data, they're not going to believe me, okay? Just being honest with you, particularly when the data looks like that. So in Norfolk, one of the things I did was bring in the Center for Policing Equity. They are a think tank group throughout the nation, very credible when it comes to adverse impact and looking at data and recommending procedures and policies to minimize that. I've already started communications with them to take a look at that data.
You know, in my years as a journalist, and I lived in Michigan, I've lived in Colorado and Texas, and this is my observation. I think black police chiefs have a tough role, and they have to respond to racially divided communities. They have the mayor, the city manager in some cases, and they also have police unions who are often critical of black leadership. And I'm not trying to be dismissive of the role you have, but why do this job? Because it sounds so unthankful.
You know, one of the things I tell my staff all the time, I like conflict. I like tough stuff. And everything you've described, it's true. You know, as an African-American police chief, it's tough. I'm not saying it's not tough for my Caucasian brothers and sisters, because it's just a tough job, period. But here's the catch. Managing the expectation of your rank and file, where they are typically are going to be folks that don't look like you. And because of the history of our nation and the history of policing, there's certain expectations on both sides. You know, give me an example. One of the things that I have to think about, something as benign as walking into a room, right? And you see Caucasian officers on one side of the room, African-American officer on one side of the room. You have to strategically think about whose hand you're going to shake first, because sometimes that becomes a story. I say that based on experience, you know, something as simple as that. Promotions. I knew when I was diversifying the rank and file, I knew that would be problematic. But I did it because it was the right thing to do. Folks were capable. It made us a more diverse department. It made us closer to our community. But you have to be brave to make those decisions sometimes. You know, I don't shrink to anything. I think when you're in a position of leadership, you have to say and do tough things. And, you know, if you're a leader that everybody likes you, I show you a leader that hadn't made tough decisions or done tough things. I'm not looking for everybody to like me. I'm looking for folks to say he's fair. Okay. He called balls and strikes. He was fair.
We ended our conversation with Chief Boone on a lighter note. Since Illinois Soul is all about amplifying black voices and music, I asked him to name his favorite R&B artists.
You made me happy. yes, you can dance.
So, as for a group, group band, Frankie Beverly and Maze.
I wanna make sure I'm right, girl.
Individual is a tie between Prince and Luther Vandross.
I just don't wanna stop. Too much, never too much, never too much, never too much.
Well, Urbana Police Chief Larry D. Boone, thank you for having a dialogue with us here at Illinois Soul.
Well, thank you, Illinois Soul, and have me back if you have anything else you want to talk about, and I'll be happy to oblige you. Thank you.
Woke up today, looked at your picture just to get me started. I called you up, but you weren't.
Let's bring you up to speed about some events around town. The Krannert Center for Performing Arts and Illinois Soul bring you the Uncorked series of concerts in celebration of Black History Month. Thursday, February 15th at 5 p.m., listen to jazz, funk, R&B, and more from Bloomington's Soft Spoken, featuring lead vocalist Jamaica Russell. On Friday, February 16th, join Illinois Public Media for a screening of the PBS docuseries Gospel.
Do you think there will always be gospel music 100 years from now?
I don't see how we can thrive without gospel music.
That's right.
I say it's going to always be there forever.
Listen, as we tell the story of how a people learn to sing the Lord's song in a strange land.
We'll watch 1 hour of the series, and then I'll moderate a discussion with experts here in Champaign-Urbana. It's all happening at the Virginia Theater in Champaign. On Sunday, February 18th, you can enjoy saxophonist Reginald Lewis and friends at the Urbana Free Library. All of these events are listed on our website, illinoisoul.org. You're listening to Dialogue, a new weekly news magazine on Illinois Soul. I'm Reginald Hardwick. The number of Black students in Illinois enrolled in college has dropped by more than a third over the past decade. A big deterrent is cost. Need-based scholarships are one way of making sure more Black students can sign up and finish school. But this type of financial aid is becoming less of a priority for many schools. Instead, they've increased spending on scholarships that target students with high GPAs and test scores. Lisa Corian-Phillip of our NPR member station in Chicago, WBEZ, has the story.
Layla Granville looks kind of winded. She took two buses, the Green Line, then walked 13 minutes to get to class today. She lives on the South Side and is a freshman at Dominican University in the western suburbs. It was a journey she had to get used to.
At first, my legs were like hurting. I didn't walk that much in like a minute.
But she's come to like the two-hour commute. She uses the train ride to read fantasy novels. They're her favorite.
I love strong female characters. Like the one I'm reading now, it's like a female assassin and she's young and she's like the best one. I'm like, you're amazing.
So is Layla. She's majoring in biochemistry with a minor in physics, which is crazy considering college was almost not in the cards for her. It really came down to one factor.
I know my family couldn't help pay for it.
Research from Gallup shows Black students like Layla often cite money as the biggest hurdle standing between them and a college degree. The Federal Reserve reports their families, on average, hold a small fraction of the wealth that white families do. Black students are more likely to have to borrow to cover tuition and to juggle full-time jobs with class.
I didn't know how I was going to pay for college, even though I wanted to go.
Fortunately for Layla, Dominican offered a lifeline, a scholarship program for students from low-income families interested in science that didn't require a high GPA. It's made it possible for Layla to go to college without taking on a bunch of debt or a job to pay her tuition. Instead, she can just focus on school.
Seeing how stressed I am about like some of the classes and like the workload, I couldn't imagine working on top of it. I don't think I would have lasted.
Many young people from low-income families don't get scholarships. Over the past two decades, colleges have shifted more and more money away from need-based scholarships to so-called merit aid for students with high GPAs and test scores. That's according to research from the think tank New America. That means instead of prioritizing full rides for low-income students like Layla, colleges are handing out what are basically tuition discounts to compete for high-achieving students who have lots of college options. Maria Bigham is with the equity nonprofit Accept Group.
The students with the higher GPAs and the higher test scores are going to come from better funded schools. They're going to have more opportunities. Chances are likely that they have more in family wealth.
College leaders defend the strategy. They say even with the merit aid, wealthy students pay more tuition and subsidize spots for students like Layla, who can't afford to pay any tuition at all. But researchers say the increased spending on merit aid has mainly benefited white, wealthy students, and it's actually reduced the number of low-income and Black students on campus. Akil Bello with the advocacy group Fair Test says the issue is not that Black and low-income students are not capable of getting good grades. It's that they're more likely to attend a high school with fewer supports and have other obligations competing for their time.
Guess what? Poor kids who have to take a part-time job are going to have a lower GPA.
Take Layla. When she was in high school, she worked at a Chili's restaurant on the weekends. She says her GPA was low and put her out of the running for most scholarships. And for Layla, getting a scholarship meant the difference not in where she went to college, but whether or not she could go at all.
I don't even have to, like, look at my financial aid thing. I'm like, I'm glad I don't have to worry about it.
Instead, she can focus on nerding out on her math and science classes. In her biology lab, she's been running genetic experiments.
I kind of felt bad because you had to, like, knock out the fruit flies.
Really?
Yeah, to, like, separate their, like, eye color.
Lisa Corian Phillip, WBEZ News.
What would you like discussed here on Dialogue? Leave a voicemail with your feedback at 217-244-1989. You can help shape our news coverage, and you can tell us what you think of the music on Illinois Soul. Tell us what's on your mind at 217-244-1989. Up next, an interview with jazz legend Branford Marsalis, who recently had a concert at the Krannert. You're listening to Dialogue from Illinois Soul. You're listening to Dialogue, a new weekly news magazine focused on Black communities of Central Illinois on Illinois Soul. I'm Reginald Hardwick, News and Public Affairs Director at Illinois Public Media. That music is from Mo Better Blues by Wesley Snipes, or so the 1990s film by the same name wants you to believe. Renowned saxophonist Branford Marsalis was really the one working the keys. 2 years after his work for the film, Marsalis became the first band leader for Jay Leno when he took over as host of The Tonight Show. Marsalis was born into a family of professional and equally famous musicians, but he didn't always know that's what he wanted to do for a living. In late January, the Branford Marsalis Quartet performed at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana. And the Grammy winner took some time to speak with my colleague, Kimberly Schofield.
Branford, thank you so much for joining me. You came from a family of musicians. Did you always know that you wanted to be a musician, or was there ever a pivotal moment that kicked you into gear?
I always knew I wanted to play music, but I never thought that I'd become a professional musician. That was mostly Wenton, who fervently believed he was going to go to New York and shock the world, and he pretty much did.
Yeah.
I'm a year older than him, so when I graduated from high school, I went to a historically Black college in Louisiana, Southern University, and I marched in the band, and I was studying to become a history teacher, and I was just going to teach history and play with a wedding band. on the weekends because I love playing.
Yeah.
But I didn't have any aspirations to leave the state. And when I went and got to New York, he just constantly bothered me with, man, you need to be up here. You don't need to be down there. You know, you can learn how to play jazz easy. You got great gifts, blah, blah, blah. And I really wasn't interested. And my dad says to me, you know, I'm not going to tell you what you should do. He says, but what I will tell you is that you don't want to be in your 30s with a couple of kids sitting around wondering if you could have done it.
Yeah.
So when he said that, I came up with a plan. I said, great, I'll go to the Berklee College of Music first because it's in Boston. It's not as expensive as New York. Mm-hmm. Work, save some money, and go visit Winton in New York and do these things.
You've done a lot of different things. You've composed for movies, you've hosted shows, and of course, you are a renowned saxophonist. Do you have a preference?
I'm a player. I have this thing. My dad used to have this saying, the thing you do most is the thing you do best. I just wrote this piece, a suite for the Kalamazoo Symphony, 20 minutes for orchestra. Mm-hmm. So then people say, well, now you're a composer. I said, well, no, I've written a composition, but I'm not a composer. And then they said, well, what's the difference? I said, composers compose. Composers don't do TV shows, play with pop stars and work with Public Enemy and play with a band and go into it. They just compose. And I know we're in this era where everything is kind of hybridized. Musicians always call themselves musician/composer.
Yeah.
It's kind of, it cheapens the title. If you write 16-bar songs, you're not a composer, you're a songwriter.
Yeah.
But composer sounds more noble than songwriter, so we go with composer. So it's just like we're in this thing where the optics matter more than everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, listening to as much classical music as I have and having as much love and respect for composers that I have, it's not a place I can go.
With your whole family being musical, when you all went on tour together, were there any challenges or did you all just have one big happy family flow together?
Man, we just a bunch of jackasses, so it really was fun. My dad was brilliant with this. When Winton started playing the trumpet, I was playing piano and I hated playing the piano. So when Winton joined the school band, I said, if I join the school band, it'll get me off this damn piano, so I'll do anything. So he says, well, what instrument do you want to play? I said, trumpet. And then he said, no, leave it to my dad. No, Einstein says that the same matter can't occupy the same space at the same time or chaos ensues. I'm like, seven. I'm like, what? What? No, you can't play the trumpet. You have to pick another instrument. How about clarinet? Okay. So I played the clarinet. And then when I was 14 years old, it's like I started noticing like girls are really beautiful creatures and I should pursue them. So I saw these three pretty girls and I followed them into a dance and I was too terrified to meet them. So I said, I get it. If I join one of these bands, I'll meet girls. So I went home and said, I want an alto saxophone. So at Christmas, I got an alto saxophone.
Nice.
As soon as I got the saxophone, I hired a much better keyboard player to join the band. And I played saxophone. And in all of that, what I learned was that the girls are attracted to the singers and the guitar players, and I still never got the girls. But still, now I was stuck with this saxophone, and I might as well just play it. So many, many years later, back to your question, yeah, we're on tour, and it's still pretty much like that. We don't play the same instrument, so there's no competition. Winton plays trumpet, I play saxophone, Delphiel plays trombone, Jason plays drums and vibes, old man played piano. We just had a good time.
What do you think about jazz currently in the 21st century? What does it look like to you?
The same thing as everything else. The optics matter. Everybody's a jazz musician now. You know, guys are playing in R&B bands talking about their jazz bona fides. Again, it's not really pejorative to me. You know, some guys get upset about it. I mean, I don't get upset about it, but I see it and I observe it. You know, the word jazz, the MacArthur Genius Grants, in the Jazz Award, they give the awards to the people who they think are moving jazz farther. And the one thing that they all have in common is that they are woefully not adept at playing traditional jazz.
jazz needs to move to a place where it no longer recognizes itself. And then other people can get awards for preserving. But so the Jazz Award is always, it always bends towards people who have a certain kind of mathematical understanding of the music. It's almost like a sin to play traditional music. None of this upsets me. I don't care. Because the general level of music and musical incompetence out here when it comes to jazz has allowed our band to work a lot. Usually at my age, we don't work as much. If you look at jazz in the 40s and the 50s, the guys who were lauded in the 80s, in their 60s or 70s, had a drop off in the middle because new young guys came up and like they were pushed aside for the up and coming players. These young guys, they're all great players. It's probably the best generation of players ever. It's incredible how well they play the instrument. They just don't play the music very well. And that's because they never really tried to check it out. I do these master classes and I say, why do you guys play jazz? It's clear you don't like jazz very much. And they never really have an answer for that other than calling me a asshole, which is fine. And they say, well, how can you say I don't like jazz? Because they say, you don't know any jazz. Because there is a jazz language. And the language of jazz is not harmony. The language of jazz is jazz. And there are some young people in New York that I've met now where they're starting to understand that the language of jazz is actually jazz. So it's not all about harmonic exploration, which has been the thing ever since, you know, Charlie Parker showed up and died. Then suddenly it became about playing changes, never about playing tunes. The reason that people struggle with liking jazz is that harmonic analysis has no personality. It doesn't have a sound, it doesn't have a beat, it doesn't have a feeling. So if your knowledge of jazz is solely based on harmony, then you will become really harmonically competent. But the music always has a thing that's missing. So when regular people listen to jazz and tell me, every time I listen to jazz, it always sounds the same. It does. It sounds the same sonically because the musicians haven't spent enough time trying to listen to the sound of jazz by listening to the earlier people. So we have all these bizarre rules that guys say, man, you know, you should be able to play an F sharp. I'm like, why? Why should I be able to play an F sharp? Well, man, don't you want to grow? If you're playing scales and patterns, then F sharp, A, G, it's all the same. It all sounds the same. We just invent this shit. We invent all these absurd rules, which makes the music more introverted and more further away from people. Songs should be happy. Songs should be sad. Songs should be angry. That's when we become magicians. I just want to be competent.
Right.
I want to be a competent jazz musician where if I fell into a time machine and it was suddenly like, you know, 1943, the musicians wouldn't say, man, get the f- off the stage. You don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You Whereas if a lot of guys that played now fell into that time machine, they'd be kicked off the stage almost immediately. Yeah, there's no like specific people where I'm like, I'm really angry at the way they play. It's just a thing that's out here. New York is full of these guys. You can see the videos all over the place. Guys are playing. And if you really try to listen to the music sonically, the songs always go to the same place emotionally because nobody's thinking about emotion. They're just thinking about harmonic competency and technical virtuosity. And they are technical virtuosos. They play the saxophone better than me. But there's certain things that I'm not willing to invest time in, especially as I get older and I have less of it. But like, you know, spending 2 months learning how to play a song in a complicated key just seems ridiculous to me since the audience wouldn't know the difference.
Yeah.
So now what I'm doing is I'm playing to impress other musicians, which defeats the whole purpose of playing music in the first place. Music is about people. It's not about itself. But what I notice with a lot of people, it's the inverse for them. Music is about itself. And I was talking to a guy talking about a set list. I said, yeah, I'm not playing any of that. And he says, why not? I said, the people won't dig it. And he says, well, man, let me ask you a question. Who do you play for? For yourself or for the people? I said, for the people. He says, that's very interesting. I said, yeah, I can play for myself in the living room. But you think that people should pay money to watch you celebrate yourself. That's really interesting. Come to my concert. Oh, and you, by the way. give me $25 to watch me show you the thing that I've worked on that you can't possibly understand. Well, that's the winning formula right there, boy.
That it is. Illinois Public Media is coming out with a radio station. It's called Illinois Soul, and it will amplify Black voices, Black music. We're going to have smooth jazz, R&B, and neo-soul, and then some gospel on the weekend. So while I'm not playing the music for the people per se, it is for the people, and I'm hoping that they respond well to it. So just reminded me of it.
It's going to be cool. I like that.
Thank you.
One of my kids turned me on to the Neo Soul stuff. I like all of it, really.
Yeah.
But my kid, you know, she really, yeah. One of my daughters, she's really into the Neo Soul thing.
Yeah.
And it was really, that was good. It was educational. I gravitate towards it a little bit. It's cool.
Well, what can we expect then when you come to Krannert? You're going to play for the people. Is everyone going to play for the people when you come to Krannert here in Urbana?
Man, we're going to play the most complicated music in the world. We're going to like stare down at them like they're roaches.
Yeah.
No, first of all, people generally hear music with their eyes.
Yeah.
I'm not mad at it.
It is like a spectacle more than.
Yeah. I mean, which is why the operative verb for concert going is see, not hear.
Mm-hmm.
People go to concerts, they say, I'm going to see blah, blah, blah.
Oh, that's
they
true.
Never say, I'm going to hear blah, blah, blah.
Never thought of that.
Yeah, well, yeah. I have to teach these kids. I have to hook all this stuff up, man. Teaching these college kids, you got to, you know. But it's like one of those things I notice. When you think about how a lot of modern jazz players look when they play, yeah, you know, it's kind of boring to look at them. They're real introverted. You know, they all wear like black T-shirts and black pants. And, you know, it's just... They're all soft-spoken, but we're the opposite of that. We wear sharp suits, and we're a bunch, and we are truly, like, I don't know if it's going to be the whole band for that gig. I hope so. We're just four jackasses, really. We tease each other incessantly on stage. We laugh a lot. We enjoy what we're doing. So even if you're not the biggest jazz fan in the world, we might play a complicated song, but we always follow it with a song that has a melody that's easy to follow because we like jazz.
Yeah.
We don't think of jazz as a vehicle to like highlight our own genius. We just like playing. We're players. And we play fast songs and slow songs and pretty songs and ugly songs and hard tunes and easy tunes. It's great to be in a band with that kind of musical versatility.
That wraps up this week's dialogue on Illinois Soul. Join us every Saturday at 11 a.m. and Tuesday at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul, FM 90.9, HD2, and FM 101.1. Our music theme was composed by Lamont Holden. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Dialogue and Illinois Soul are brought to you by Illinois Public Media, which is a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Please enjoy the week, and we'll dialogue with you again next week.